Good evening and welcome to Jazz Unlimited. My name is Dennis Owsley. I'm celebrating my 30th anniversary of continually bringing jazz to St. Louis on the air. We're going to celebrate this with an 8-part documentary on the jazz history of St. Louis. We're going to have the people that made that history talk about it. We're going to have the music. This week, we're going to be taking a listen to the Ragtime era and the Roaring Twenties. A couple of questions about St. Louis history come out of this. How much did Ragtime play a part in the 1904 World's Fair? And also, were the bands on the riverboat excursions during the 20s jazz bands or 1920s versions of cover bands? All this and more following NPR News. I'm Dennis Owsley. This is Jazz Unlimited's show on the jazz history of St. Louis, and this is part one. And before we begin tonight's show, we have to thank Trey Bertishner, Charlie Manise, David Hines, Clark Terry, Singleton Palmer, Jim Wallace, and Kevin Powell, the University of Missouri Jazz Musician Archives, and Will Warner. The original Jazz History of St. Louis documentary was funded by a grant from the Missouri Arts Council and was copyright 1987 KWMU. Trumpet players have shaped the sound and direction of St. Louis jazz from the beginning. The sound of a St. Louis trumpet player is unmistakable, whether the trumpeter is Charles Kreth, Miles Davis, Clark Terry, or Lester Bowie. That unique sound is described as a clear singing tone with many bent notes reminiscent of the human voice. St. Louis has made specific contributions to American music over the years. It was the first center for ragtime music. The first great lyrical jazz saxophone stylist, Frank Trumbauer, spent much of his early career here. He was the major influence on Lester Young. A line of trumpeters from Charles Kreth to Miles Davis and Lester Bowie changed the way we think about music. Davis changed the course of jazz 4 times during his career, while Bowie was part of an avant-garde that challenged the way jazz is played. St. Louis is dominated by Catholic and German traditions. Judge Nathan Young, a noted African-American historian and founder of the St. Louis American newspaper, will talk about these influences.
New Orleans and its music and its background, that has a French background. Because there you had the French opera, and all the people went to the French opera there. And you have a delicate type of music that grew out of New Orleans. Jelly Roll Morton and his type of music has a delicacy about it that is French. And up in St. Louis, where the Germans came after the Revolution in 48, the German Americans came here and they brought their culture and their music. And the black St. Louisans were ready to listen to it and partake of it. For one thing is, the German culture and music was very much like what the black culture and music was. It had bottom to it. It had bass and contralto and alto and part singing. And the first musicians in St. Louis that disseminated music were the Germans. Or if you wanted to take a lesson in music in St. Louis, you'd have to go to a German teacher. All the band instruments and all the band music was German. And so the black musicians, the early black musicians, all had German teachers.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is Jazz Unlimited's Jazz History of St. Louis. Blues from the Mississippi Delta influenced the music of St. Louis. It's always had a large and at times vibrant blues community. Thus, a trumpet player in St. Louis has the vocal inflections of the Mississippi Delta blues laid over the German brass band tradition's singing tone. St. Louis trumpeters use many bent notes with vocal effects produced by mutes that are not found in trumpeters from river cities further to the north. St. Louis is a river town and influences have come and gone, and no regional style of jazz has grown up here. In many respects, St. Louis has always been a city that looked down the Mississippi. Because of this, much of the great black migrations of the last part of the 19th century and the years of World War II bypassed St. Louis and went on to Chicago. Here is Milt Hinton talking about his parents and why they went north.
Chicago was more or less like the center of the United States. And everybody was trying to get to Chicago. All conventions were held there. This is before airlines, because you couldn't expect people in California to go to New York and vice versa. So everybody met in Chicago. The big hotels were there. The greatest stockyards in the world was there. And there was plenty of work for unskilled labor, which the black folks in the South had. And we were all migrating. My folks migrated from Mississippi.
Early jazz history is a collection of myths, legends, racial and political agendas, and all of the early jazz writers happened to be left-wing. It is true that New Orleans musicians such as Louis Armstrong spent part of their early careers on excursion boats working out of St. Louis, but most moved on to Chicago and New York by rail and did not remain in St. Louis. Before the 1920s, jazz musicians boarded trains and traveled all over the United States. New Orleans jazz men were found in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Kansas City, Dallas, Chicago, St. Louis, and New York well before 1919, the date given when jazz supposedly broke out of New Orleans. Two periods in the city's music history have produced highly original music. In both periods, it appeared that the power structure of the city ignored the artists. During the ragtime period, it was heard in a district informally designated as a vice district, where drinking, gambling, and prostitution were tolerated. The first rag published by an African American was Harlem Rag, written by Tom Turpin and published in 1897. That was Harlem Rag, played by Milton Keys. The Vice or Sporting District was known as Chestnut Valley and was an entertainment area for African Americans who worked on the steamboats that plied the Mississippi from New Orleans to St. Paul. According to Trey Bertitschner, another factor in the development of St. Louis as the National Ragtime Center was...
There's several historical factors involved. I think there was one of the main ones was the massive black migration north in 93, and a lot of people stayed here and settled in St. Louis. There was a district that developed here and just was let alone really by the city fathers, and I think this was a black area. And it was originally around Targee Street, which is long gone. It was a little street that connected Market and Clark that would run right through the middle of Kiel Auditorium. But that was the center for, let's say, early black activity in music around the 1890s, early 90s. And that moved out around Union Station, and this became the hotbed for ragtime. A lot of the piano players going and coming through town could always be assured finding a job. It's one of the places on Market or Chestnut, and that's really where ragtime grew up.
The sporting district of St. Louis attracted people of all races, including W.C. Handy. In his autobiography, Father of the Blues, he said, "I wouldn't want to forget Targee Street as it was then. The high roller Stetson hats of the men or the diamonds the girls wore in their ears. Then there were those who sat for company in little plush parlors under gas lights. A lover's quarrel between Alan Johnny Britt and his girlfriend Frankie Baker that ended in a Targee Street saloon was immortalized by the ballad Frankie and Johnny." Trey Bertitschner comments on unsuccessful efforts by moralists to close down Chestnut Valley.
I think it's sort of agreed that that tune was an ancient imported tune, you know, from Europe someplace, but it was adapted here and it became the ballad. The legend, a St. Louis legend, says that a piano player by the name of Dooley picked up on a local homicide case, and that Frankie and Johnny case in 1899, and that he created it. But this is a legend, of course. But it's true that it did become famous from here. And I think the first publication of the tune was around 1914. Well, there seems to have been just general apathy about it. The city fathers just didn't seem to get too involved with it. There was one priest down on a church at 16th and Pine, Father Coffey, who became very vocal about the district, and he succeeded in helping get a law passed called the Newbury Law in the early 90s. Part of the Newbury Law stipulated a removal of musical instruments from saloons and wine rooms. This was rarely enforced. And Father Coffey found himself reassigned to another parish all of a sudden. There was a lot of power in the district, and he got a little bit too vocal about it.
A good case can be made that Tom Turpin, not Scott Joplin, was the king of ragtime in St. Louis. Turpin was a large man, and his piano at his Rosebud Bar was set up on blocks so that he could play standing up. The Rosebud and the adjacent Hurrah Club was the gathering place for such people as pianists Scott Joplin, Scott Hayden, Arthur Marshall, Joe Jordan, and Louis Chavon. Here's a set of three piano rags played by Milton Keys following the station break. They are The Pippin Rag, written by James Marshall, Heliotrope Bouquet, written by Joplin and Chavon, and Nappy Lee, written by Joe Jordan. Thank you. I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is Jazz Unlimited's History of Jazz in St. Louis. The better-known ragtime composer Scott Joplin was apparently in and out of St. Louis from around 1885 to 1894. Trey Bertishner comments on Joplin and his arrival in St. Louis and how he and his publisher John Stark moved to St. Louis. His Maple Leaf Rag put ragtime on the map, and we will hear, after Tishner, a actual piano roll played by Joplin in 1906 of Maple Leaf Rag.
Scott Joplin, of course, was here, legend says, as early as 1885, but Joplin did not move here until 1900. Turpin was published as early as 1897. In fact, his first rag was the first black rag to be published nationally, called the Harlem Rag. It was published in St. Louis here. And Joplin was published in 1899 in Sedalia, and then he and publisher Stark moved here in 1900, and this became the center for classic ragtime.
St. Louis has forgotten many things, but the 1904 World's Fair is not one of them. At that never-forgotten World's Fair, ragtime was only heard on the Midway. Joplin didn't play at this event, although his composition, The Cascades, was written in honor of the event and became quite popular. According to Tishner, the 1904 World's Fair was good for the musicians, and here is Joplin playing the Cascades on a piano roll, also from 1906.
For the ragtime players, it was good because it gave them more opportunities to work that year. And most of the players found a job on the pike. which is a tremendous entertainment area, the midway area of the fair. Ragtime was not an official part of the fair. The legend is that the city fathers were afraid that ragtime would overrun the fair. There persists a legend that Scott Joplin played at the World's Fair. There's really no evidence of that. But he did, of course, write the Cascades in commemoration of it. But about as close to authentic ragtime as got on the fair docket was, let's say, Sousa playing Cakewalks. That's about as close as it got. But most of the ragtime was kind of underground. You know, the Players were on, the Pike, the Rosebud was buzzing. It was good for the musicians that year.
Arthur Marshall was heard at the Spanish Cafe. Sam Patterson and Louis Chavon performed duo ragtime piano and songs at a beer hall called the Old St. Louis Levee Club. In addition to the Cascades, St. Louis Rag, Tom Turpin, On the Pike, James Scott, St. Louis Tickle, Theron C. Bennett were also written for the fair. Ironically, the best-known song of the fair, Meet Me in St. Louis, was written by Andrew B. Sterling and Kerry Mills, and neither man attended the fair. When the fair closed, the musicians began to drift away to Chicago because there were more opportunities in that city. A lingering question about the performance practices of ragtime goes as follows. Is there evidence that early rags were improvised, or were they set pieces that musicians worked out and someone eventually wrote down? Tabor Tischner addresses this question.
I think the earliest days of ragtime, it was definitely a performer's art, and there was a lot of improvisation going on. There's one player who recorded late in life. His name was Bruin Campbell. He was known as the Ragtime Kid, and he palled around with Scott Joplin. Late in life, he recorded some tunes the way he played them in St. Louis and Sedalia, and there's a lot of improvisation and a surprising amount of blues influence in his music, and I think it evolved into a written music for the piano because the piano was the hottest instrument around at the turn of the century. Everybody had a piano, and there was a market for sheet music that was incredible. It's like videotapes today and records. You know, people bought sheet music in those days.
The closing of the Rosebud Bar in 1906 hastened the demise of Chestnut Valley and its sporting district. Soon, blues musicians began to migrate to an area known as Deep Morgan on Biddle Street, which was north of the city. In Deep Morgan, the bars mainly had blues musicians working in them. This was the start of the blues community in St. Louis that continues to this day. W.C. Handy also spent some time in St. Louis before 1900, and his composition, The St. Louis Blues, has been an unofficial ambassador for the city. Sources claim that Biddle Street was the source of the lyrics of this composition. Trevor Tishner comments on W.C. Handy's ties to the ragtime era. And following the station break, Tishner will discuss W.C. Handy in St. Louis. I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is Jazz Unlimited. The St. Louis Blues is the second most recorded song in jazz and swing music. The Tom Lord discography lists over 1,847 recordings of the composition up to approximately 2011. Here is the great recording of it by Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong in 1925.
Handy talked about coming through here in 93 and stayed for very briefly on Chargy Street and then went on to Chicago, as a lot of musicians did for the World's Fair that year in Chicago. Yeah, those Handy tunes are published earlier than a lot of people realize. 1914, Memphis Blues was published in 1912, and they were originally marketed as rags. Because this, and they, of course, we don't recognize Yellow Dog Blues as a rag, but it was published as Yellow Dog Rag because this was the ragtime era. They were marketed as blue rags or ragtime blues, and then, of course, that's all forgotten today. But the original editions have ragtime on the cover, even St. Louis Blues.
The St. Louis Blues, done by Bessie Smith on vocal, Louis Armstrong on cornet, and Fred Longshaw on harmonium. By 1910, Chestnut Valley had ceased being the entertainment center. but Tom Turpin and his brother Charles were entrepreneurs. Charles won an election as district constable in 1910, and Tom opened the Eureka Club in the same year, but without the success of the Rosebud Cafe. Charles also owned the Booker T. Washington Theater, a vaudeville theater on Market. Tom was the music director of that enterprise by 1913. But before Tom Turpin was the music director, Artie Matthews was the music director, and he published the first blues, Baby Seal Blues, in August 1912, which was 2 months before W.C. Handy's more famous Memphis Blues. In jazz circles, Matthews is known as the composer of Weary Blues, and annual ragtime pianists and annual ragtime piano contests were a feature of the Booker T. Washington. An important event took place at the Booker T. Washington Theater in 1916. The African-American patrons of the theater began to demand more high-class acts, even if it meant hiring white acts. According to the St. Louis Argus, the black acts were not changing their routines, were undependable, and were using routines smacking of minstrelsy. Clark and Lovere were the first white act to appear at the Booker T. Washington Theater. St. Louis and Eva Taylor was a vaudeville performer from an early age, and she performed at the age of 3 at Orpheum Theater in St. Louis. And by 1904, she was so popular she began touring all over the world. She eventually settled in New York in 1921 and began working with Clarence Williams, whom she eventually married. She recorded under her name with his Blue Five and was an active jazz vocalist until 1974. Are you aware that Jelly Roll Morton visited and played in St. Louis in 1914? And by around 1916, classic ragtime was no longer popular and was evolving into different styles. One of the styles was something called novelty piano. Here is an example of it, called Kitten on the Keys, written by the composer Zez Confrey. Another style in this evolution was stride piano, played here on a James P. Johnson piano roll in 1917, and this is Steeplechase Rag. Thank you. Kitten on the Keys, and then Steeplechase Rag, a piano roll by James B. Johnson in 1917. An important pre-jazz African-American vaudeville act, the Creole Band, played at various white theaters during 1915 to 1917. The Creole Band personnel included trumpeter Freddie Keppard and bassist Bill Johnson. Keppard was one of the great New Orleans trumpet players who went on to a career in Chicago during the 20s, and Bill Johnson was an important jazz man throughout the 20s and 30s. He had a long career with the King Oliver Creole Jazz Band, clarinetist Johnny Dodds, and others. The Creole Band was recorded for RCA Victor on December 2nd, 1917, almost 2 years after the original Dixieland Jazz Band was recorded, but the recordings were never issued. Music making during this period in both white and black communities in St. Louis also took place in cabarets, and more importantly, in community bands that served not only as entertainments, but as places for instructing young musicians. Most of the well-known musicians in and from St. Louis in the 20s went through these bands. Two of the band leader teachers in these bands were William Blue and P.B. Langford. Most of the major African-American brass players in St. Louis came through the Oddfellows Band, with Langford as the bandmaster. And we're going to hear a community military band playing something called Slightest Trombonus. And it's an example of maybe what these community bands might have sounded like. Was a community band called the Sodera Military Band doing Slightest Trombonus. Musicians in the community bands played for functions held by social clubs. The major dance hall in the black community was Pythian Hall, while in the white community, it was Dreamland Ballroom, and that eventually became the Arcadia Ballroom after 1925. Boggs Cafe, Jimmy Collins Garden Cafe, the Keystone Garden, Rathskeller Garden were cabarets that used black musicians. And the Chauffeurs Club, an important after-hours club in the 1920s, opened in 1915. By the 1890s, excursions on riverboats were a major feature of life in St. Louis. Usually, social groups booked the excursions, and most excursions included a band for dancing and other entertainment. The excursion boats remained strictly segregated until 1969. African Americans were only allowed on the boats on Monday nights. Racial segregation on the riverboats and in other establishments led to the formation of two musicians' unions. Both black and white unions were formed about the same time in 1896. While the majority of the customers on the riverboats, the bawdy houses, and circuses were white, both black and white segregated bands played for them. White musicians never played for black audiences. The white musicians local was mostly concerned with concert bands, the symphony orchestra, and theater pit bands, while the black musicians local dealt with small groups playing parties and dances. The wage scale and minimum number of musicians for jobs were the same for both groups in St. Louis up until the Great Depression happened. The Streckwa Steamers of New Orleans began bringing boats into St. Louis in 1911 and eventually became the dominant excursion company on the St. Louis waterfront. A black man from Paducah, Kentucky, pianist Fate Marable, had been leading bands of white musicians playing ragtime on excursion boats from 1907 until 1917. Captain John Streckfus sent Marable north to St. Louis to play solo piano opposite the white Gene Rodemick band in 1918. And then in 1919, Marable brought an all-black New Orleans band to St. Louis on the St. Paul. That band included Louis Armstrong and Norman Mason, trumpets, Davy Jones, mellophone, Paul Dominguez, violin, Sam Dutry, clarinet, Baby Dodds, drums. Marable played piano with Pops Foster, bass, and Johnny St. Cyr on banjo. After a tentative start on their first night, they became a sensation in St. Louis. And the jazz history of St. Louis will continue with jazz in the 1920s. Following the station break, I'm Dennis Owsley.